BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. Tonight's show has come to you from Bristol City Centre and is part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Tonight we welcome Roger from the Bristol Radical History Group, who's here to talk about their involvement with the Seven Stars pub down the road by the Fleece and Firkin, and how it was involved in the abolition of the slave trade. Matt Lewis is here with more of Matt's very popular feature, If I Were Prime Minister. This gives you, the public, the chance to change the path of history by introducing your own laws. Jeff Sparks gives us the latest in his now legendary What's On guide, and Malcolm Grieve continues with another chapter of Cider with Rosie. But before all that, let's hear Nina Simone. That was Nina Simone singing My Baby Just Cares For Me. And now for Tony Gosling with a report on Spinwatch.
My name's Tom Griffin. I work for Spinwatch, which is an organisation based in Glasgow, which looks at spin and disinformation, propaganda, whether from the government or from corporations or wherever.
Why should anybody go to your website?
Basically, to get, you know, the context that, you know, you're not getting from the media about, you know, who people are, why they're pushing particular arguments, and why some of those arguments may be misleading.
So are you saying that some independent experts are actually maybe not as independent as they seem?
Yes. A lot of corporate PR uses things like front groups. You know, health groups, which are pushing particular angles, are not necessarily bona fide health groups, but fronts for diet companies, things like that. Well, the classic example, and the one where it really came out, was with the Policy Exchange Newsnight, where Policy Exchange did this report on British mosques and about the literature that they were carrying in their bookshops, saying that they were carrying extremist literature, and it was covered across all the press, the Times, the Telegraph, and many other papers, and it was going to be covered on Newsnight as well, but almost by chance, I think Newsnight realised that some of the receipts that some of the evidence that Policy Exchange were relying on was not was not correct. And they looked into the receipts for these books, and they found that some of them were receipts from two different places had been written in one on top of the other. The receipts were not the actual documents that the particular bookshops put out. So basically, Policy Exchange couldn't stand up its evidence. So you have to look at why are they putting out evidence which is skewed to reflect a particular picture. I think it made people think twice about accepting these stories at face value, even though there's still a lot of it going on pretty much as before. But papers did have to apologise to various mosques over that story. The media has now started to report a bit more about the background of Policy Exchange. There was a profile in The Guardian recently which picked up on some of the same issues that we've been researching about. Dean Godson, who's the Director of Research for Terrorism, he actually has a long background in propaganda. He was working with the Institute for European Defence and Strategic Studies in the 1980s, pushing propaganda for Star Wars, the missile defence system then. That was an offshoot of the Heritage Foundation, which his brother actually worked for. His brother, Roy Godson, who actually came under investigation in the 80s as part of the Iran-Contra affair. Now, Roy Godson has actually written about disinformation propaganda techniques as an academic.
You've got a couple of books with you, I see there. I wonder if you could just talk about those. And these are written by the brother of the director of the Policy Exchange, which was involved in this sort of faking evidence that mosques were peddling really extremist Islamic literature.
I mean, this one is Dirty Tricks or Trump Cards, which is all about how to sort of influence politics without... in an unacknowledged way. I mean, I think he gives a definition of covert action here somewhere. If I can find it, it's... he's got the definition here. Covert action, or to use the British term, special political action, is the attempt by a government or group to influence events in another state or territory without revealing its own involvement. And what he's actually doing in this book is making the case for the US government to utilise that kind of capability.
So yeah, the book's actually called Dirty Tricks or Trump Cards, US Covert Action and Counterintelligence by Roy Godson, a new introduction by the author. So he's really saying in the title that whilst some people might say these are dirty tricks, infiltrating these lies into the press, he's saying that actually it can have a decisive political effect.
Yeah, I mean, there's a chapter on sort of which goes into propaganda and disinformation and different types, you know, black propaganda, grey... to white propaganda.
Can you just explain what the difference between... I've heard those terms before, maybe people haven't. What is the difference between white, black and grey propaganda?
Well, I mean, it's actually quite definite within the sort of the intelligence world. It's quite definite, clear categories. White propaganda basically is completely open propaganda. So stuff like the British Council, the US Information Agency, the stuff like that is white propaganda. Grey propaganda is propaganda that you... it's deniable, you don't acknowledge it, but people... who look into things can probably figure it out fairly easily. And black propaganda is propaganda that is deliberately completely hidden, well hidden, usually because it would reflect extremely badly on the real source, and it, which often overlaps with disinformation, which is, when you're putting out information which is just not true and which is designed to mislead. Now, the other book I've got here is Strategic Denial and Deception, which is edited by Roy Godson. But the interesting thing about it is that it's got a chapter by Abram Shulsky, who went on to become the head of the Office of Special Plans at the Pentagon in the lead up to the Iraq War. So they were the people putting out the case for the Iraq War. And I'll just read you a little bit from his Abram Shulsky's chapter. Deception refers to the effort to cause an adversary to believe something that is not true, to believe a cover story rather than the truth, with the goal of leading him to react in a way that serves one's own interest rather than his. This involves creating the impression via leaks, planted information, decoys, etc., that the truth is other than it actually is. That is creating an alternative reality in which the target is induced to believe. Now, what I would ask is, isn't that exactly what the Office of Special Plans did in the run-up to the Iraq War? When he was there.
Can you just give us the web address and briefly explain, you know, how the site operates?
Yeah, it's www.spinwatch.org. It's basically it's a non-profit organisation which just looks at spin disinformation, whether it's by corporations or governments. We have a lot of different writers. Some concentrate on environmental issues, water, the role of water companies and things like that. People there from Unlock Democracy as well.
Basically, the idea is that you come up with a corporation or a name of someone you see on TV, and that on the site you get information into their background and what their prejudices might be, and something to find out a little bit more, look a bit more deeply into who these people are.
That was Tony Gosling reporting on Spinwatch, and thanks to Tom Griffin for his contribution to that. They're based at Strathclyde University, and if you want to have a look and find out more, the website address, once again, is www.spinwatch.org. Toot and the Maytals with their version of Bam Bam. Now for Matt's feature, which gives you, the public, the chance to be Prime Minister for a day. Now this week it's the turn of Lynn from Bedminster. Take it away.
Now Lynn, you are our Prime Minister of the week, and you've got up to three laws that you can pass. You don't have to use all three, but let's start with your first one. What would you like to see happen? What really annoys you? If you were Prime Minister for the day, what law would you pass?
Okay, well, probably my first law would be that I would make it so that everybody, after they passed their initial driving test, had to do another test to learn how to drive on the motorway. Because one thing that really bugs me is people sitting in the middle lane, and motorways get so congested, and there's never anything in the slow lane, and all the cars are in the fast lane because of all these people sitting in the middle lane. So I'd make it a law that everybody had to take another test to learn how to drive on the motorway. That would be my first one.
Right, can I make a slight omission here? I have actually, I might be guilty of sitting in the middle lane occasionally myself, and I don't know why other people do it, but I basically, this is my reason. I think it's maybe, in my mind, it's more dangerous to kind of keep on coming into the slow lane, keep on pulling out to the middle lane, keep on going back into the slow lane every time you overtake, and you're constantly moving lane in and out, in and out. And every time you move lane, there's a heightened chance of an accident. So I always think, if I can see that I'm going to have to overtake ahead of me in like a brief couple of seconds, I'll kind of think, well, I'll just stay in the middle lane. And of course, then you see more things that you're going to have to overtake and more reasons why moving into the slow lane is going to be really temporary. So that's kind of my excuse. What do you say to that?
Well, you could be right, I suppose. I don't know. I mean, I was always taught by my dad, He always told me, always be in the slow lane unless you're overtaking. And I've always stuck to that because what my dad told me was always, I felt was, you know, quite important. But you could be right. And maybe it's just that motorways are just far too busy and there's too many cars. So maybe we should pass a law about people only owning one car. Maybe that should be the law. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay, well, thank you for that. I think you're right. Where there's someone in the middle lane and it's obvious the slow lane is completely empty and they've just fallen asleep, metaphorically or maybe literally, then fair enough. But where you're having to go in and out, that must be more dangerous than just staying in the middle lane. I don't know. We'll see what the listeners say about that. Thank you, Lynn.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
We've got Lynn again with her second law now. Lynn, over to you.
Okay, my second law, which I think is particularly relevant at this time of year, is that I would make it that nobody anywhere could put up any kind of Christmas decoration, Christmas promotion, Christmas advertising, or absolutely anything to do with Christmas before December the 1st, because I just find it crazy that we have stuff going up in, you know, shops with their Christmas biscuits and their Christmas foods and stuff, and their advertising, well, as far back as they can think they can get away with it, to be honest. And I find the level of consumerism at Christmas just sickening sometimes, so at least to keep it within some tight confines would maybe help to calm things down a bit. So yeah, that would be my second law.
You're not a curmudgeon, are you, Lynn?
With that risk of sounding ignorant, what's a curmudgeon?
Well, someone who's like a bit kind of bah humbug.
Oh right, yeah, the Scrooge type. I'm getting that way. I think it's age. I used to love Christmas when I was younger, absolutely loved it. But, you know, they're getting presents and the tree and I don't know, it just feels lovely. And Christmas Day is really nice, actually. I really like the feeling of Christmas Day. It is really lovely. It's just, I don't know, there's just this thing, people seem to go into this spending frenzy at Christmas before Christmas, and I'm sure we can have all the lovely bits of Christmas without people going completely ridiculous and getting themselves into huge amounts of debt buying these fantastic electrical things for their kids that their kids really don't need. And it doesn't, and it just, I don't think it has to be about that for Christmas to be lovely. So I wouldn't want to sound too bar humbug, because there is great stuff about Christmas, and I think it's a great time for everybody to relax, and well, as long as they haven't got family conflicts and fighting at the dinner table, but you know, generally it's a great time of year, lots of fun and people, you know, all getting together and having fun and stuff. But I think it can get a bit over the top with the retail stuff.
I'm inclined to agree with you there. I think if Christmas is about sharing time together, brilliant. If it's about trying to, like, keep everybody happy by spending money on them, then I think that might be where we're going wrong. But hopefully with the recession, people will realise that actually you can have an amazing Christmas and not be spending loads of money. So I know the recession is by no means good for anybody, but that there might be a slight silver lining to the cloud if people back away from this kind of frenzy of spending that you've talked about. I don't know. We'll see what listeners say. Thank you very much, Lynn. Two excellent laws there.
Thank you, Lynn from Bedminster, and we look forward to next week's contribution.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Now I'd like to welcome Roger from the Bristol Radical History Group to the studio. Hello, Roger.
All right.
Tell us a little bit about the Bristol Radical History Group.
Okay, we were formed about 3 years ago. We've kind of come from a background which is probably not very sort of normal for historians. I can't say that we're all historians, whatever that means. But basically, we come out of a sports club. We're a bunch of footballers and cricketers, some of whom were interested in history or local history, Atlantic history, and we read books, and we decided to stop boring our footballer friends and cricketer friends and actually do something. So we kind of got together and started putting events on. And the last 3 years, we've done, I think, 75 events, which are all sorts of different things, from talks to history recreations to gigs and storytelling, all sorts of things like that.
So how many of you are there, roughly, now?
Well, I mean, it's a difficult question, really, because, you could say there's probably a core group of about 10 or 15 of us, but we kind of exist in a wider network which contains sort of people who obviously put gigs on and play in bands, but also sports people, but also other historians and academics and can-can dancers and right. All sorts of odd people. So it's a kind of a network, really, I'd say. So it's hard to say. But I'd say, to give an idea, I mean, we've had several thousand people come into our events and probably several hundred people involved in organising them.
Right, so it's expanded pretty drastically. I mean, do you have like a kind of a place that you meet? How do you meet up? I mean, Bristol covers quite a wide area.
Well, being a network, we network through pubs mostly. So we.
Well, that sounds all right.
Yeah. So well, it's a good place to actually organise things. But we do have sort of formal meetings, but most of the time we sort of work in a sort of network, mostly based around in Easton, in East Bristol. So.
Okay, well, you say you meet in pubs. You're very interested in one particular pub, very close to us here. It's the Seven Stars by the Fleece and Firkin. Tell me a bit about your interest in that.
Well, yeah, I mean, we kind of became aware of it. I mean, if you know about this, last year was the bicentennial commemoration of the abolition of the slave trade in the British Empire. So 200 years since the slave trade was actually legally banned by Parliament. There were obviously a series of celebrations and commemorations that were put on by Bristol City Council and other sort of civic bodies.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, during that time, no physical legacy was actually left in the city. I mean, we were kind of expecting something which would recognise the horrors of the slave trade and of course, its connection to Bristol's merchants, who were very much involved in profiting from it and politically supporting that trade for many hundreds of years. So we felt that something needed to be put in place to kind of recognise the suffering. I mean, to give you an idea, I think the British part of the slave trade moved around 4 million West Africans across from Africa into the Caribbean, obviously with significant suffering and loss of life, you know, which, you know, has not really been kind of recognised, I think, as in a physical sense in Bristol itself. So
yeah, I mean, considering the wealth that Bristol has generated, the only real evidence I see left behind, apart from an awful lot of expensive buildings, really, is Black Boy Hill, I think, pretty much there. So did you find it an uphill struggle to try and leave some kind of a legacy?
Yeah, I mean, we you know, we were sort of looking at the events that were going on, and we put our own events on, which were coming from particularly from a radical history perspective last year. I mean, for example, you know, we believe that the slave trade and slavery itself was mainly, or one of the main forces that wiped it out, was slave revolts, which occurred, numerous slave revolts throughout the Caribbean, particularly ending in 1831 with a huge rebellion in Jamaica. So we were trying to popularise some of the ideas of important parts of history which are kind of neglected by the official history, which is that William Wilberforce was the guy and he kind of put it together in Parliament and then everybody decided it was bad and the British Empire banned it. Well, in fact, that's not really what happened. There was actually a mass abolition movement in Britain against the slave trade and slavery, and there were many people involved in that movement. One of the key figures was a guy called Thomas Clarkson. And the reason that most people don't know his name, he was actually written out of the history by William Wilberforce's sons, who wrote the history of the abolition movement.
Right.
So now he's connected to the Seven Stars, which is a pub near the Fleece and Firkin. And we regard that pub and that meeting point as a really key moment in history, and particularly in the abolition of the slave trade. Just to give you an idea what happened, I mean, in the 1780s, a very small group of people in London met together, 15 people, met in a print shop, and decided they were going to overthrow the slave trade. And at that stage, very little information was available to the public. And the main reason was, of course, is that the Atlantic crossings were completely invisible. There was no media, there were no film or, you know, photographs.
Yeah.
So the whole of that, the horrors of the transatlantic crossings were kind of hidden from the public. And also, of course, the plantations and what went on in the plantations in the Caribbean. So what this group of abolitionists set out to do was to try and get information, to find out what was actually going on the ships, in the plantations. And that was very hard to do. And the reason was because of all the people who were profiting from the trade, including the merchant venturers in Bristol, the slave ship captains, the banks, the plantation owners, nobody wanted to talk, obviously. It wasn't in their interest to talk about the horrors of the trade. So Clarkson was kind of tasked with coming to Bristol and finding information about the trade. And luckily, and very luckily, he stumbled upon or was directed to a landlord of a pub, the Seven Stars, on the dockside in Bristol. And this landlord, Thompson, we don't even know his first name, but Thompson was an abolitionist himself, and he kind of met up with Clarkson, and together the key thing they did was they tracked down the people, the one group of people who had no interest in keeping quiet about it, and they were the slave ship sailors, of course, who there were many, you know, hundreds of, if not thousands, in Bristol. So through this meeting, Clarkson, you've got to understand, Clarkson was a Cambridge University graduate, so he wasn't exactly used to hanging around on docksides in the 1780s. But through Thompson's connection, through the Seven Stars, he started to meet slave ship sailors, and they spilled the beans. And they not only talked about what it was like being on those ships, but Clarkson uncovered a whole load of facts which were really, really important. And the first thing was that the slave ship sailors had an awful life themselves. I mean, the actual death rate amongst sailors, he did the studies in the Merchant Venture Archives, that most of the death rate amongst slave ship sailors was actually higher than the slaves themselves, which was quite interesting. And also, the job was hated. Working on slave ships was hated by sailors. They were dangerous. There was disease. They had to sit off the West African coast getting yellow fever. There were slave revolts or mutinies on the ships. And also, the sailors themselves were treated appallingly by their captains and by the officers, which was part of being being a sailor in the 18th century. So they had no interest in protecting the trade. And lastly, and most interestingly, he discovered, of course, was that of course, nobody wanted to work on slave ships. They had to have a system for press-ganging sailors into it, and that was called crimping. So what they did was they got sailors into debt, threw them in prison, and then said the only way you can get out of prison is to go and work on a slave ship. So effectively the sailors were forced labourers as well, interestingly.
Okay. When you've done these gigs and events, have you found a lot of unease about Bristol's involvement in the slave trade still now?
Yeah, there is. I mean, I think if you treat it as some kind of guilt thing, then, you know, I can understand, you know, there is resentment. I mean, I know, for example, last year that there was a big debate on television and on Points West, and they were asking questions like, should Bristol apologise for the slave trade? Well, I think that's a ridiculous question, because if an apology is any use at all, and apology is an interesting thing because it doesn't actually mean anything's going to be done to recompense those people who are... Or, you know, the Caribbean, for example, where extracted huge amounts of wealth was extracted from and not put back. But the second thing is that, well, no, why should Bristol apologise for slave trade? I mean, perhaps the only organisation that you should start with who should be making apologies is the Society of Merchant Venturers, who were directly involved in it, profited from it. Well, they were involved in the debate and on television, interestingly, and they tried to deny their involvement, which was quite funny because there were a lot of academics and historians there who laughed out loud when they tried to do that. So, you know, even today, you know, this organisation is still trying to kind of cover up its history. So we're very much into, like, you know, bringing this history to light. But I don't think Bristolians are responsible for it, but there are a lot of people still sitting on property and wealth that was made out of that in Clifton.
So perhaps an apology would act as a public acknowledgement of our position and Bristol's wealth being based largely on the slave trade. Well, so there is an argument for it,
surely. Yeah, I think it's an argument for the organisations that still exist and still, you know, I certainly think that, you know, the wealth can be tracked. You know, the wealth that was made out of slave trade, quite easily tracked in Bristol. We know the families that still have land and wealth in Clifton, for example. And I personally think they should actually have that land taken off them, and the money should be turned into producing schools and hospitals in the Caribbean. But that's my personal view. I don't think ordinary Bristolians are responsible whatsoever.
So the Bristol Radical History Group, in terms of a lot of history groups or historians that may already exist, how do you differ from other history? How is your view of history and what should be done with that history different that makes you radical?
Well, I think the key thing to start with is to recognise that, you know, there is no one history, and what we're taught in schools, and, you know, there are different ways of approaching history. So, for example, a lot of people, when I was brought up in school, I was taught the great men theory of history, which is that, you know, that key figures in history, particularly, you know, sort of kings and queens, or, you know, sort of aristocrats, made the decisions that affect our lives. But actually, if you look at history from I think since the Second World War, we've been doing it very effectively. We've started to look from a perspective of social history, which is saying, well, how do people actually involved, what are their everyday lives are like? That's one part of it.
Yeah.
How did people really live? But more importantly, how have they actually affected change? So a good example is the abolition movement, where it's presented as a great man, William Wilberforce, but in fact was a mass movement. I mean, most people in Britain don't know that, say, 350,000 people were boycotting sugar, for example, as a mass campaign against the slave trade. Also, the petitions that were signed, and we've got to remember there was no democracy in Britain at the time, you know, very, very small percentage of the population can vote, but there were millions of signatures on those petitions, you know, that were signed. It was a mass movement across the country. It involved many, many activists, and women in particular were very much involved in it and set their own groups up. So that's an example, looking from history from below, you know, what was this movement? How did it affect change? And that applies to all sorts of aspects of history. So we tend to look from the bottom. We're looking for where people affect change.
Okay, tell us what about events that are coming up soon? What are you going to be doing?
Well, the first main thing, which is connected to Seven Stars, is that we are currently putting together, we're raising money for a plaque which recognises Thomas Clarkson, the slave ship sailors, and the landlord Thompson, and that plaque is going to be unveiled, I think, on March the 23rd next year. Mm-hmm. So we're currently actually going to the foundry next in the start of January, I think. So it's a pretty major project. So that's one event. We're also planning to recreate the trial and execution of Charles I at the end of January, January the 31st, and then we've got our Radical History Week next year, which is in October. So.
Okay. So how can people contribute financially towards the costs of all of this? Because you're only footballers and cricketers, after all.
Well, yeah, that's true. But, we are interested in public donations. I mean, so far we've raised about half the money, about £1,500, which has mainly come from gigs, and we sell a pamphlet about it as well, which is on sale in the Seven Stars and other places in Bristol. But, if you want to make a donation, I mean, I do think it's a worthwhile thing. I think it's very good that we leave a physical legacy to commemorate the abolition of slave trade in Bristol, at least something. And obviously the City Council failed to do that. So, yeah, the way to do it really is to get in contact with us. And you can do that, first of all, to check our website out, which is www.brh.org.uk. So it's brh.org.uk. Or you can email us on brh@brh.org.uk. If you get in contact with us, you would like to make a donation, or you've got ideas about fundraising, then, you know, get in contact and we'll talk.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much for coming in, Roger, and all the best. And the magic date is March the 23rd to go down for the unveiling. And just a reminder again, we'll say at the end of the programme, if you want to get in touch with them, brh.org.uk to make a contribution. Thank you.
Cheers.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, Jeff Sparks is poised over the microphone with all the attention of a hawk ready to deliver with lightning speed what's on this week.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Kicking off with Friday 19th of December and at the Cascalot, which is moored alongside the Arnolfini in Bristol, Gonga will be performing with support from Gurkha, Big Naturals and K-Tunk. Doors open at 7pm and tickets are £7 in advance and £8 on the door. Also on 19th of December, at the Louisiana in Bristol, Gavin Thorpe will be performing with support from Roger Tarry. Doors open at 8pm and tickets are £6 in advance. Moving on to Song of the Week, and I present Andrew Prince. I first saw this musician at an open mic night in Glastonbury recently, and he really impressed me. His main choice of instrument is a Chapman stick, which is a two-handed fretboard tapping instrument. The song you're about to hear is a work in progress and is titled Waiting for Sunrise. Thank you. That was Andrew Prince with Waiting for Sunrise. For more information, you can check out myspace.com/AM Prince. On to Saturday 20th of December, at the Bunch of Grapes in Bristol, the Mudheads will be performing. The gig starts around 9 p.m. and entry is free. Keeping with 20th of December and at the Barrel, which is in Thornbury, Bristol, the Mangold Wurzels will be performing. The gig starts at 9 p.m. and entry is free. Finally, on to Sunday 21st of December and at the Seven Stars in Thomas Lane, Bristol, it's the Acoustic Afternoon, which starts at 3 p.m. and is free entry. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Well, it certainly sounds like there are lots of distractions to keep us from forgetting to do our Christmas shopping. Excellent stuff. Now it's time for our very own reading of Cider with Rosie, abridged and read especially for Daleks by Malcolm Grieve.
Cider with Rosie by Laurie Lee. The day Rosie Burdock decided to take me in hand was a motionless day of summer, creamy, hazy and amber-coloured, with the beech trees standing in heavy sunlight, as though clogged in wild, wet honey. It was the time of haymaking, so when we came out of school, Jack and I went to the farm to help. The whir of the mower met us across the stubble. Rabbits jumped like firecrackers about in the fields, and the hay smelt crisp and sweet. The farmer's men were all hard at work, raking, turning and loading. Tall, whiskered fellows forked the grass, their chests like bramble patches. The air swung with their forks, and the swathes took wing and rose like eagles to the tops of the wagons. The farmer gave us a short fork each, and we both pitched in with the rest. I stumbled on Rosie behind a haycock, and she grinned up at me with the sly, glittering eyes of her mother. She wore her tartan frock and cheap brass necklace, and her bare legs were brown with hay dust. "Get out of there," I said. "Go on." Rosie had grown and was hefty now, and I was terrified of her. In her cat-like eyes and curling mouth, I saw unnatural wisdoms, more threatening than anything I could imagine. The last time we'd met, I'd hit her with a cabbage stump. She bore me no grudge, just grinned. "I got something to show you." "You push off," I said. I felt dry and dripping, icy hot. Her eyes glinted, and I stood rooted. Her face was wrapped in a pulsating haze, and her body seemed to flicker with lightning. "You thirsty?" she said. "I ain't, so there." "You be," she said. "Come on." So I stuck the fork into the ringing ground and followed her, like doom. We went a long way, to the bottom of the field, where a wagon stood half-loaded. Festoons of untrimmed grass hung down like curtains around it. We crawled underneath, between the wheels, into a herb-scented cave of darkness. Rosie scratched about, turned over a sack and revealed a stone jar of cider. "It's cider," she said. "You went to drink it, though. Not much of it, at any rate." Huge and squat, the jar lay on the grass like an unexploded bomb. We lifted it up, unscrewed the stopper, and smelt the whiff of fermented apples. I held the jar to my mouth and rolled my eyes sideways like a beast at a waterhole. "Go on," said Rosie. I took a deep breath. Never to be forgotten, that first long secret drink of golden fire, juice of those valleys and of that time, wine of wild orchards, of russet summer, of plump red apples, and Rosie's burning cheeks. Never to be forgotten or ever tasted again. I put down the jar with a gulp and a gasp. Then I turned to look at Rosie. She was yellow and dusty with buttercups and seemed to be purring in the gloom. Her hair was rich as a wild bee's nest, and her eyes were full of stings. I did not know what to do with her, nor did I know what not to do. She looked smooth and precious, a thing of unplumbable mysteries, and perilous as quicksand. "Rosie," I said, on my knees and shaking. She crawled with a rustle of grass towards me, quick and superbly assured. Her hand in mine was like a small wet flame, which I could neither hold nor throw away. Then Rosie, with a remorseless, reedy strength, pulled me down from my tottering perch, pulled me down, down into her wide green smile, and into the deep, subaqueous grass. Then I remembered little, and that little vaguely. Skin drums beat in my head. Rosie was close up, salty, an invisible touch, too near to be seen or measured. And it seemed that the wagon under which we lay went floating away like a barge, out over the valley where we rocked unseen, swinging on motionless tides. Then she took off her boots and stuffed them with flowers. She did the same with mine. Her parched voice crackled like flames in my ears. More fires were started. I drank more cider. Rosie told me outrageous fantasies. She liked me, she said, better than Walt or Ken, Boney Harris, or even the curate. And I admitted to her, in a loud, rough voice, that she was even prettier than Betty Gleed. For a long time, we sat with our mouths very close, breathing the same hot air. We kissed. Once only. So dry and shy, it was like two leaves colliding in air. At last the cuckoo stopped singing and slid into the woods. The mowers went home and left us. I heard Jack calling as he went down the lane, calling my name till I heard him no more. And still we lay in our wagon of grass, tugging at each other's hands, while her husky, perilous whisper drugged me and the cider beat gongs in my head. Night came at last, and we crawled out of the wagon and stumbled together towards home. Bright dew and glowworms shone over the grass, and the heat of the day grew softer. I felt like a giant. I swung from the trees and plunged my arms into nettles just to show her. Whatever I did seemed valiant and easy. Rosie carried her boots and smiled. There was something about that evening which dilates the memory, even now. The long hills slavered like Chinese dragons, crimson in the setting sun. The shifting lane lassoed my feet and tried to trip me up, and the lake as we passed it rose hissing with waves and tried to drown us among its cannibal fish. Perhaps I fell in, though I don't remember. But here I lost Rosie for good. I found myself wandering home alone, wet through, and possessed by miracles. I discovered extraordinary tricks of sight. I could make trees move and leapfrog each other, and turn bushes into roaring trains. I could lick up the stars like acid drops, and fall flat on my face without pain. I felt magnificent, fateful, and for the first time in my life invulnerable to the perils of night. When at last I reached home, still dripping wet, I was bursting with power and pleasure. I sat on the chopping block and sang "Fierce Raged the Tempest" and several other hymns of that nature. I went on singing till long after supper time, bawling alone in the dark. Then Harold and Jack came and frog-marched me to bed. I was never the same again.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'd like to introduce to the studio Martin Summers, a former Eastern European analyst at the New Economics Foundation and a published author with a book on post-Soviet economics. Hello. Tell us a little bit about what you think is going on at the moment in our economy. We hear a lot of panic and a lot of crisis, and a lot of people may just see this as something we're reading in the papers and signs outside Woolworths saying they've gone into administration. Is this just sort of a self-fulfilling problem where we just sort of talk ourselves into panic and then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy and then there is a crisis?
I think there is a crisis of confidence in the world economy. The world stock markets are still all over the place, but mostly down. The world car industry, which is a key industry, seems to be bankrupt. And so also, of course, once you get to a point like this, panic is self-fulfilling. So the more people panic, the more panic there is. Mm. And of course, the authorities, whether they are big bankers or governments, are trying to calm things. That's their job. But the underlying problems are pretty acute.
I mean, in a week that's seen church meetings in Detroit holding prayers for the revival of the car industry with sort of big cars made in Detroit being parked inside the church. Do you think we're all panicking too much and blowing this out of proportion? Do you think we should be more confident?
No. I think what's happened is we've had 30 years of mismanagement and you've now reached the point where that can no longer be sustained. I think we're looking to governments to try and sort this out now. Of course, government wasn't supposed to have anything to do with managing the economy. That's what we've been wrong for the last 30 years. We've kidded ourselves that the government somehow had nothing to do with it. Mm. But of course, when it comes to the crunch, it is the government and only the government, whether it's the US government or the British government, whoever, that people look to try and solve the problem. The problem is that the crash of the private sector is so profound that governments quite likely have not got the resources or the ideas to deal with the problem. That's not to say that things can't be done. Probably things could be done, but they're a lot more radical than has been attempted so far.
Do you think the government should have more or less involvement generally in how economics is run to try and avoid this problem again?
Well, look, we're now going through a situation where we're chucking taxpayers' imaginary money in order to try and keep the private banking sector up. The fact is the private banking sector is bust, all of it. Even the bits that are left, which are supposedly private, if the state hadn't propped up the rest of the banking system, they too would collapse. So in other words, what we've got is a state of denial by the political class that they are now responsible for the financial side of the economy. Yeah? So if you think back to August 2007, the markets were riding high, everybody thought that the private sector was going to decide everything, so you still have Brown going on about private sector finance to build hospitals and so on and so forth. Mm. But that has actually just gone. But they're like cartoon characters who've walked off the edge of a cliff and they're not looking down. So when people talk about confidence and so on, yes, they shouldn't look down because they'll fall, but then, you know, that's what's got to happen when you've walked off the edge of a cliff. And if you're going to deal with the problem, you've got to actually assess the size of it and be realistic about it.
Okay, I mean, both Gordon and Barack Obama, the president-elect at the moment, are engaging in the same gamble. They're simply going to spend more and more and more money and pump it into the economy and hope that, as would usually happen, this will prop the economy up and get it going like a kick up the
ass. Yes, this is all very strange because, of course, for years we were told that we couldn't possibly do this, and then suddenly overnight we're all doing it. Mm. But, of course, we're not really doing it. The money is being chucked at the banks, yeah? Now, what you should do, in fact, in my view, is let the banks collapse and then the government steps in with money to do useful things. Let's cut out the middleman. What's going on at the moment is we're throwing money at the banks in the hope that they will be resurrected. Yeah. and then we'll resurrect the economy. And this is going about things the wrong way. The banks are basically finished. But, of course, the political class doesn't want to accept that because it's very scary. It means that, you know, all private banking is effectively off for the duration.
Yeah.
But that means that the state has got to step in and do something sensible. Now, the election of Barack Obama is a hopeful sign. It shows that there isn't a complete death wish amongst the American electorate.
Yeah.
But at the same time, he is being pushed by his Wall Street financial backers to stick with the already agreed policy, which is effectively to try and resurrect the banking system using public resources. And I don't think that can work.
We don't really have a common structure in place for a lot of central government control of the economy because we've been used to having a private sector. Isn't this a little bit like putting ignorant people in charge of a lot of powerful levers?
Well, it is. I mean, the problem is that the state ought to have had a plan B in the locker.
Mm.
But instead, they're making it up on the hoof in a situation that they'd rather not have been in.
Right.
Now, that means, of course, that they're obviously making some mistakes, in my view. For example, they are still attempting to resurrect the bubble. That's what all this chucking the money at the banks means. Let's get the bubble going again. Let's get people spending. Let's get people in more debt. Yep. Now, that's how we got into the mess in the first place. Getting people into more debt to spend more money is not a solution. That's just that, even if it were to happen, which it isn't going to happen, it would just be a return to, let's just go back to where we were in August 2007 and forget any of this ever happened.
Right, I mean, when it comes up to the election very soon, what are the other parties have to say on this? Are they going to be doing the same
thing?
Well,
that's quite interesting, because for the very first time in a generation, we've got the Labour Party saying that we've got to actually expand government expenditure here, because otherwise the economy will collapse. And the Tories not quite sure what to say. Mm. I mean, traditionally, cool. The Tories would have said, no, we've got to cut government expenditure. But since everybody in the whole world, apart from them, thinks that we've got to increase government expenditure, they've been facing both ways and hopping from one foot to the other. I think what it shows is that all of them are unprepared for this crisis.
Do you think George Osborne has the calibre to be able to stand up to dealing with this problem if he becomes...
Well, no, I don't think any of them have. I mean, he's pretty useless, but then the people in charge are not that brilliant either. I mean, the idea that just by expanding the government expenditure and borrowing a bit, you'll be able to fend off what has been growing for 30 years is laughable. At least they're starting to face in the right direction. Mm. Yeah, it is going to be the governments that are going to have to sort this out. The private sector isn't going to resurrect itself from the grave. It isn't going to happen.
So basically what you're saying is it looks like we're pretty much screwed.
It's pretty bad, but at the same time, maybe, it's about time. If you think back to the Jubilee 2000 a few years ago, demanding debt relief for developing countries and so on, nothing very much happened about that, despite all the talk.
Yeah.
What could happen now is that we really do grasp the nettle and say, right, these countries are forgiven their debts. Because mm-hmm. that's a key thing to do.
Do you think that's likely to happen?
I think it'll have to happen in the end. It'll have to happen. Do you see the riots that are now beginning and general strikes in Greece? This is just the beginning. There's going to be huge political upheaval all over the world, and people are going to demand that governments do something. I don't think governments are prepared or have thought through what to do, but they'll have to think of something, just as they did in the 1930s. And, of course, what they might think of is what was thought of in Germany, which is let's put everybody in uniform and go to war. We don't want that, but that's definitely a possibility.
Mm-hmm. We have a feature of our old Prime Minister. If you were Chancellor tomorrow or today, even now, what are you going to do?
I would expand government expenditure, as they are doing. I would raise taxes on the rich, because they're not going to spend that money anyway, and they don't need it. If you think of all the extra money that they've got through all of these inside-dealing scams over the years, all of that money stays in their hands. Why should we, if there's a big gap now in the budget because we've got to bail the banks out, where should we get the money from to fill that gap? Well, from the people who've got money, the ones who made money in the 30 years of this neoliberal boom, so-called. So, we've just got to get back to some old-fashioned politics, real politics, where you say, look, if we're going to do something, we're going to have to get the resources from somewhere. That means getting them off the wealthy. And then we've got to go, we'll have to go to elections and make sure that that's what happens if that's what people want. But if we don't start, we're in a halfway house at the moment now, where we're talking about expanding the government's role, but we've got no resources to expand that role beyond a certain limit. And also the money is being thrown at trying to resurrect the private banks. If I was the Chancellor of the Exchequer or a Labour Prime Minister, I'd be saying, now look, folks, private banking is over. What are we going to do now? But of course, none of them are prepared to say that, because it's just outside of their comfort zone completely. But they're going to be forced to, because that is the situation.
In terms of how this actually affects real people, so far, we understand that it affects people's mortgages and their households, and it also affects credit cards. What is the deal with both of those? Is it going to get worse and worse in both of those ways?
Yeah, well, you're going to find more people unable to pay their mortgages. Credit card debt is now the main... People are using credit cards to pay existing debts. So last month in the US, the second biggest receiver of credit card payments was McDonald's. Yeah, so people are going to McDonald's to buy their tea with the credit card. That cannot be sustained. Yeah. So what people are using up their last resources of credit. And when that finishes, then there will be even further consequences. we're all going to have to change the way we live. I mean, this was all this underlying all of this is resources running out. It's competition between the haves and the have-nots. It's all of the underlying problems of the system are finally coming out into the open. So, although I'm sounding very negative,
yeah,
in a way, this had to happen,
yeah,
because it's been building up for so long. And it's about time everybody just grew up and got on with facing the reality, which is most people on this planet don't have anything like what they deserve to have in terms of basic human security. And we've just got to do something about it. Of course, that solves your problem with the economy. If all these people have actually got money to pay for their water and education and what have you,
yeah,
then the economy can run. But if you concentrate all the wealth in the hands of a tiny minority that don't know how to spend it because they can't possibly spend it, then the whole thing begins to topple over. Redistribution is actually efficient. It's not just a kind of fairness argument. It's also an efficiency argument.
On that note, thank you very much, Martin Summers. That's the end of this week's Dalek Radio Show from the Bristol Radio Co-op, based in the city centre. Today's studio guests were Roger from the Bristol Radical History Group and also Martin Summers. The feature on Spinwatch was brought to us by Tony Gosling. And Prime Minister for a Day was the inspiration of Matt Lewis. And today's Prime Minister was Lynn from Bedminster. Jeff Sparks brought us the What's On Guide, and Malcolm Grieve read another instalment of Sided with Rosie to be continued next week. Phyllis Stitch-Curran was the studio engineer, and this week's show was produced by Kayleigh Porter. You can download the show off the internet on www.dialectradio.co.uk. Thank you very much to Tom Griffin, who helped with the feature on Spinwatch. Goodbye from me, John Peters Coleman, and until next week, take care of yourselves, and goodbye.